Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. Welcome to the program and podcast that helps you learn and improve your American English. We do this by telling you about interesting stories from around the world. But we do it in a special way. We always speak more slowly than normal, and we use words and sentences that are easier to understand. If English is not your first language, the way we present these stories can make learning a lot easier. We also urge you to download and save the program. That way you can listen to it over and over and practice speaking English the American way. Today's show is all about music. First, we will travel to America's Northeast to visit a famous place where great music has been played for 75 years. Then we're off to Africa, Kenya, in fact, to hear how some old music technology is becoming popular once again. As It is coming to you from Washington on VOA. Let's get started with part one. The world-famous Boston Symphony Orchestra normally performs at Symphony Hall in Boston, Massachusetts. But its summer home is the Tanglewood Music Center in Western Massachusetts. The Boston Symphony Orchestra also has a summer program at Tanglewood. It is designed for young singers, musicians, and those who create musical works. Composers like Aaron Copland, Leonard Bernstein, and John Adams have worked there. This summer, the Tanglewood Music Center has been celebrating its 75th anniversary. Bob Doty has our story.
Serge Koutsevitsky led the Boston Symphony Orchestra in 1940. At the time, Europe was at war. The United States did not enter World War II until the end of 1941. Mr. Koutsevitsky persuaded people in the music industry to open a music school at Tanglewood, the BSO's summer home. He wanted young, gifted musicians to attend the school for free. But within 2 years, the program almost came to an end. Jeremy Eichler is a music critic for the Boston Globe newspaper.
The BSO trustees wanted to close the school because of the war, and Koutsevitsky was outraged and wrote a letter calling it an act of artistic vandalism and said precisely now is the time when the world needs to be hearing this music.
This music was not just works by Beethoven or Brahms. It was the sounds of the time. Mr. Koutsevitsky chose composer Aaron Copland to head the school. Ellen Heistein is the current director of the Tanglewood Music Center.
In establishing Aaron Copland as the head of the school, not as the head of composition, but the head of the school, he was making a very specific statement. And I think he felt very strongly that paying attention to the music of one's own time is the way to ensure that there will be a future.
Paul Hindemith was a refugee from the war in Europe. He was chosen as the first head of Tanglewood's music composition department. He and Copland decided that the school would be a place where composers write new musical works. Their first performance was Alleluia, a piece written by American composer Randall Thompson. Alleluia has opened the school's program every summer since it was first performed. Alleluia, Alleluia, Alleluia. Since it opened, Tanglewood's young musicians, singers, and conductors have performed many new compositions. They include the first American performance of Benjamin Britten's opera, Peter Grimes. This year, for its 75th anniversary, the Center asked composers to write 34 new pieces of music. I'm Bob Doty.
This is VOA, the Voice of America. We come to you every day from Washington. A music store in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, was once a popular place for East African musicians to perform. The music they played combined the styles from many African countries. Much of that music was recorded on vinyl records. They lost popularity when CDs and MP3s were invented. But now, vinyl records are regaining their popularity, and the lost music is once again being heard.
So what do we got here? Okay, this is a Luo band.
This is Abdul Karim, owner of the Melodica Music Store in downtown Nairobi. He spoke with VOA's East Africa correspondent, Gabe Josselo, who reported this story. Mr. Karim's father opened the store in 1971. Many musicians recorded their music there. They came to the store from throughout Kenya, Tanzania, and Congo. Their music was a mix of styles from those and other East African countries.
Some of these guys, like I said, they just learn off how to play a guitar basically on their own without any education. And then they just come up with their own kind of beats and then say, all right, we're going to go and, you know, sell a goat and head off into Nairobi and go find a recording music store. And bam, they would be at the door entrance, you know, playing their guitars, trying to impress. It's really amazing.
Mr. Karim says the store was crowded with musicians in the 1970s and 80s. He says people stood outside the store and listened to the music that was being played and recorded inside. But in the 80s, people began buying music on cassette tapes. In the 90s, CDs became popular. Soon, the last factory in Nairobi that made vinyl records closed. Families sold or threw away their record players. The music that had been recorded at Melodica for vinyl was put into storage. But vinyl records are starting to become popular again, and the music is once again being heard. James Rugami has been selling vinyl records at the Kenyatta Market in the capital since 1989.
There were people who thought I was crazy. They could come over and have a look and say, what are we keeping this for? But today they are coming back and appreciating. I'm so happy because even very, very young people.
Mr. Rugami says his sales have increased 40% over the past 2 years.
The day before yesterday, I served two very interesting girls. One was from, she told me she came from, she's from Canada. And the other one was from Seattle, Washington. One was 19 and the other one was 17. They knew what they were looking for.
He says his customers want African music.
No question about that. African, especially from guys from across the borders. They're coming looking for African, and the older, the better.
Both Mr. Rugami and Mr. Karim say people from throughout the world are contacting them to buy African records. Facebook groups have formed in Kenya, and fans of African music on vinyl records have monthly listening parties. Mr. Karim is buying new record players called turntables from China to help meet the growing demand. The old music of East Africa is once again being played and enjoyed. I'm Jim Tedder. This is VOA, the Voice of America. We come to you every day from Washington to help you learn and improve your American English.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. A recent agreement between the American Heart Association and China could reduce deaths from heart attack and stroke in China and possibly beyond. Cardiovascular disease, including stroke and heart attack, is the main cause of early death in China and many developing countries. Studies show that cardiovascular disease kills more than 17 million people around the world every year. In the next 15 years, that number is expected to rise to 23 million. These deaths are, for the most part, preventable. Douglas Boyle works for the American Heart Association. He spoke at the agreement signing ceremony in Washington, D.C. Mr. Boyle said the partnership can help people live longer and healthier lives. The agreement between the American Heart Association and China has three main parts. It calls for increasing opportunities for researchers, healthcare providers, and public health specialists in the U.S. to meet with those in China. The agreement also seeks the sharing of cardiovascular research. And finally, it calls for training in China of life-saving techniques, such as cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. CPR can restart a stopped heart. CPR has helped lower death rates from heart disease in the United States by 30%. Improvements in medical science and educational campaigns about preventing heart disease also played a part. The American Heart Association says teaching CPR to the people of China may help save lives. China's population is very large. So the association says it is highly likely that a bystander will need to help someone who is in cardiac arrest. Cardiac arrest is the sudden loss of heart activity, breathing, and consciousness. CPR combines rescue breathing and chest compressions. To perform the compressions, place one hand over the other and press firmly on the center of the victim's chest. Rescue breathing requires breathing into the victim's mouth to provide oxygen to the person's lungs. Compressions are administered by pressing firmly on the center of the victim's chest repeatedly. This permits oxygen-rich blood to continue flowing until the heartbeat and breathing are restored. The question is, will a bystander in China give CPR to a complete stranger having a heart attack? Several media reports have suggested that people in China may be resistant to helping strangers in medical emergencies. This could be because the person helping can be held legally responsible for damage to the injured person. Several of these reports went viral on the web. These incidents may be few, but they draw attention to a lacking area of China's legal system. According to the China Daily, as well as other newspapers, China does not have a national Good Samaritan law. Good Samaritan laws protect people who aid others in medical need. I'm Anna Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history. I'm Steve Ember. This week, the presidential election of 1800. The candidates included President John Adams of the Federalist Party and Vice President Thomas Jefferson of the Republican Party. As president, John Adams was head of the Federalist Party, but the power of that position really belonged to former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. For this and other reasons, Adams did not like Hamilton. He said he would rather be a minister to Europe under Jefferson than a president controlled by Hamilton. Hamilton did not like Adams either. Hamilton did everything he could to block Adams from becoming president again. He gave his support to another Federalist candidate, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney of South Carolina. Under the electoral system at that time, the candidate with the most votes became president. The candidate with the second highest number of votes became vice president. A Federalist victory in the election of 1800 would not be easy. The Republicans had a very strong and popular candidate in Thomas Jefferson. So Federalist Party leaders attempted to change the electoral system. The Constitution said state legislatures were to choose electors to vote for president. The Federalists tried to gain control over the legislature's decisions. They wanted Congress to create a special committee to rule if an elector had or did not have the right to vote. The committee could say if an elector's vote should be counted or thrown away. The committee would have 6 members from the Senate and 6 members from the House of Representatives. The 13th member would be the Chief Justice of the United States. Creating such a committee violated the Constitution. Federalist leaders knew this, so they wanted Congress to approve the committee but keep the measure secret until after the election. The Federalists held a majority of seats in the Senate, and the Senate voted to approve the proposal. But some Federalist members of the House of Representatives denounced it. They made many changes in the proposal. The Senate refused to accept the changes. Without agreement by both houses of Congress, the bill died. Federalist leaders saw their hopes for an election victory begin to disappear. By the summer of 1800, Thomas Jefferson's Republican Party had strong leaders in every state. It had many newspapers to express party ideas. Jefferson decided to take a holiday at Monticello, his farm in Virginia. The Republican Party leader in New York was a lawyer, Aaron Burr. Burr had served as an officer under General George Washington during America's War for Independence from Britain. After the war, he joined the Federalist Party and was elected to the United States Senate. Later, he changed parties and became a Republican. In 1800, a group of both Federalists and Republicans supported him as a candidate for president. Mm-hmm. Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton were bitter enemies. When Hamilton learned of his own party's support for electing Burr, his reaction was quick and sharp. "Anybody," he said, "even Thomas Jefferson, is better than Aaron Burr. Jefferson is not dangerous. Burr is. Jefferson's ideas of government are wrong, but at least he is an honest man. Burr is a man without honesty and character. He will destroy America," Hamilton said. The president elected in 1800 would govern from a new capital city. The national government would move from Philadelphia to Washington, a newly built city in the District of Columbia. It was along the Potomac River between the states of Maryland and Virginia. When President Adams and his wife Abigail arrived in Washington, they found a frontier town. There were few houses or streets. Mrs. Adams could not believe what she saw. She wrote to her daughter, "This is a city only because we call it a city. Our house here is very big, but the rooms are not finished. There is almost no furniture. There are not enough lamps for light." John Adams also wrote to his wife about the house where the president would live. In a letter, he asked heaven to bless the house and whoever lived in it. A later president asked for Adams' blessing to be carved above a fireplace.
There is a mantle there with an inscription from John Adams saying, "May all future residents of this house be virtuous creatures."
Joseph Ellis is a historian and the author of many books about America's founding fathers. He says John Adams' words can still be found in the White House today. A street called Pennsylvania Avenue went from the president's house to the Capitol building where Congress would meet. On each side of the street, where buildings stand today, there were fields of mud. This was the new federal city, the new capital of the United States. This was where the winner of the presidential election of 1800 would begin his term of office. John Ferling taught American history at the University of West Georgia. He says Jefferson's party campaigned better and listened to the concerns of ordinary people.
The Republicans, the Jeffersonians, understood the American political process, the more democratic process that was coming into being, better than the Federalists did, and it enabled them to win a couple of key states, and that spelled doom for Adams.
George Washington won America's first two presidential elections without opposition. John Adams won the third presidential election by 3 electoral votes. This time, in 1800, there was no clear winner. When the electors' votes were counted, President Adams had 65 votes. But Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr each had 73 votes. So under the Constitution, the House of Representatives would have to choose between Jefferson and Burr, the candidates with the highest number of votes. Each congressman could vote, but each state had just one vote. That vote would go to the candidate supported by a majority of congressmen from the state. A candidate had to receive a majority of the state votes to win. In 1800, that meant 9 of the 16 states. The Federalists saw the situation as their last chance to control the presidency. They had two plans. They would try to block the Congress from electing either Jefferson or Burr as president. Then they would try to find a way to put executive power in the hands of a Federalist. If that plan failed, they were prepared to elect Burr. The Federalists tried to make people believe that Burr was working with them against Jefferson. Burr denied this. In a letter to Jefferson, Burr wrote, "Every Republican wants you to be President of the United States. Every good Republican wants to serve under you. I would be happy and honored to be your Vice President. And if you believe I could help you better in some other position, I would do so." On February 11th, the House of Representatives began to count votes state by state. 8 states chose Jefferson. 6 chose Burr. The representatives of 2 states, Maryland and Vermont, gave each man an equal number of votes. There was no majority within those states, so neither man won the votes of those states. The voting continued. All that day and throughout the night, the representatives voted. 27 times, the count remained the same. 8 states for Jefferson, 6 for Burr, 2 undecided. The next morning, the representatives decided to rest for 4 hours. The voting began again at noon. There was no change. The 13th of February passed, then the 14th and 15th. Still no change. The House voted 33 times. It could not elect a president. A change in the vote of just one congressman from Maryland or Vermont could decide the contest. Later, after the election, the representative from Delaware said, he had met with 2 congressmen from Maryland and 1 from Vermont. All were Federalists. All had voted for Aaron Burr. The Delaware congressman said, they claimed they spoke with a friend of Thomas Jefferson. He said they told Jefferson's friend they would change their votes if Jefferson made certain promises. Jefferson denied that he had made any political promises. He said many men tried to get promises from him, but he said he told all of them that he would never become president with his hands tied. The House of Representatives voted for the 36th time on February 17th. 10 states, including Maryland and Vermont, voted for Thomas Jefferson. 4 states voted for Aaron Burr. 2 states, Delaware and South Carolina, did not vote, but Jefferson had the majority he needed. The start of Jefferson's presidency will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Learning English.